But worst of all, Americans were losing the confidence and optimism about the future that has made us unique in the world. Parents were beginning to doubt that their children would have the better life that has been the dream of every American generation. We can all be proud that pessimism is ended. America is coming back and is more confident than ever about the future.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you'd like to learn more about this podcast, visit lastborninthewilderness.com. Links in the description below. If you'd like to drop Patrick a line, there are two ways to do that. For those in the United States, you can call the phone number 208-918-2837 and leave a voicemail of up to 3 minutes in length. Second, you can drop an audio file by following the instructions through the link in the description of this episode. Thanks for listening.
Now, we're accused of having a secret. Well, if we have, it is that we're going to keep the mighty engine of this nation revved up, and that means a future of sustained economic growth without inflation that's going to create for our children and grandchildren a prosperity that finally will last.
In this episode, I speak with Henry Giroux. Henry currently holds the McMaster University Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest in the English and Cultural Studies Department and is the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy. And his primary research areas are cultural studies, youth studies, critical pedagogy, popular culture, media studies, social theory, and the politics of higher and public education, and is particularly interested in what he calls the war on youth, the corporatization of higher education, the politics of neoliberalism, the assault on civic literacy, and the collapse of public memory, public pedagogy, the educative nature of politics, and the rise of various youth movements across the globe. And in this interview with Henry, in particular, we discuss an article that was published in Truthout very recently, Neoliberalism Paved the Way for Authoritarian Right-Wing Populism, as well as what is discussed in his most recent book, The Terror of the Unforeseen, published through Los Angeles Review of Books. So in this discussion with Henry, I ask him first to break down what is neoliberalism. It is a term that we hear often when we are very critical of the late capitalist system that we are currently embedded within. What is neoliberalism? Where did it come from? And how does it enhance, as Henry poses in a lot of his work, how does it enhance the most extreme and worst aspects of the dynamics of capitalism in societies in particular, and the rise of far-right populism and a fascist politics? This is something that we're seeing embodied, for instance, in Trump and other far-right leaders like Bolsonaro in Brazil or Orban in Hungary or various other examples that we can look to. How is neoliberalism as an ideology, as a socioeconomic system, hollowed out our cultures, our communities, our public education system, all the various other areas of public life? How has it hollowed out our lives in such a way as to make room for far-right ideologies to swell and flourish in this time? This is incredibly important because, as I've discussed in previous interviews, which I've talked about far-right organizing, far-right ideology, some of the ideas that are very common, popular in far-right groups, aside from just breaking those things down, where does this come from? What fuels the fire, so to speak? I asked Henry at the very beginning to give us a clear definition and a history of where neoliberalism has come from, starting, of course, with policies back in the 70s all the way up to the Reagan administration. Then we see, of course, moving into the Clinton and Bush and Obama and now into the Trump presidencies. We're really seeing how neoliberalism has become a vehicle for the rise as it were, of these far-right ideologies and populist movements, as we see again in these populist far-right leaders. You know, as we are seeing here in the United States and what we're seeing also happening in many other places around the world, we're seeing a sort of desperation giving way to a far-right reactionary politics, a fascist politics. It's very important that we understand where this comes from, because it's in the policies of such presidents as, say, Barack Obama, Clinton, Bush, and everyone that has come before them that has paved the way for leaders like Trump. As Henry says towards the end of this, you know, and as I've said before as well, Trump is a symptom of a deeper problem. He is indicative of a system that has been trying to profit and privatize every aspect of our lives and turn it into something that can be bought and sold in a marketplace. This logic is killing us. This ideology is killing us. And how has the far right, how has the right wing in general used this desperation, this hollowing out of our culture and our society as a way to further their agendas, which are divisive, which want to other minorities and disenfranchised groups of people, to the point where we're seeing now with the rise of Trump, this horrendous rhetoric, this deeply misogynistic, chauvinistic, racist language that he uses, which normalizes, unfortunately normalizes these types of policies and this type of language. So the term that Henry uses is a neoliberal fascism, and he explains very well what he means by that. I really thank Henry for taking time to talk to me about this, going over his incredible work, his ideas in this field. So Henry, again, thank you so much for the time. If you want to learn more about Henry, you can go to his website, henryagirux.com. His last name is spelled G-I-R-O-U-X. Go there. You can follow him on Twitter. I'll put a link down below to his Twitter account, and I'll also provide a link to the article that we reference in this, Neoliberalism Paved the Way for Authoritarian Right-Wing Populism, published in Truthout, as well as a link to his most recent book, The Terror of the Unforeseen, published by Los Angeles Review of Books. Please go check out Henry's work. It's indispensable, deeply important work in this time that we're in. Thank you all for listening. Here's my interview with Henry Giroux. All right, well, Henry, it's really great to have you on the podcast. Thank you again, as we were discussing before we started. I just thank you for your work. You're prolific, and prolific isn't even a strong enough word, I think, to describe how many articles you put out, how much work you put out, how many books you've written. It's truly astounding. I mean, you know, I've just barely dipped my toes into some of your work, and I'm just it's incredible stuff. So I just have to compliment you for doing what you've been doing for so long. So thank you for being with me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I think these kinds of outlets are enormously important at a time when the corporate media is so powerful, so strong. Its educational function almost overwhelming in terms of the damage that it does, in terms of what it leaves out, and the kind of tepid analysis that it provides, among other things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's interesting trying to do independent media, independent podcasts. There's so many of them, but it's like, I mean, the information's out there, and I just try to do my best on my part to just get it out there, and people that are at all interested in it and want to get more context and understanding of the time we're in, whatever angle I choose to come at it with through this work. But I think it's really important what you've provided in your work and understanding how the groundwork has been laid for rising authoritarianism, kind of a far-right fascist politics that we're now seeing. I think many people are baffled because there is this almost, there's a lack of historical context that often people have. I think what I see often is, particularly right now, and I want to get into this maybe a little later, but with these impeachment inquiry that's happening right now with Trump, there's a lot of this hope that if we get rid of Trump, that somehow we'll magically go back to this era of kind of, I don't know, you know, the sense that the presidency has been tarnished by this kind of megalomaniac individual. But I think it's important to understand where he came from. You know, he's not an anomaly by any means.
He's a symptom. And I think that many people really fail to recognize that. I mean, it's too easy to mimic reality TV and celebrity culture by suggesting that he's just a kind of buffooning aberration. And I think that's nonsense. I mean, as you've just pointed out, I mean, Trump is the endpoint of a long series of pathologies, economic, political, and ideological, that have taken place in the United States over the last 40 years, particularly since the 1980s. And if we don't see that, if we don't recognize that, then what, you know, Trumpism, or whatever you want to call it, is certainly not going to go away by virtue of his disappearance.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he is a symptom of something else that's happening. And, you know, and we're seeing this trend all over the world. We're seeing the rise of authoritarian, even fascistic or neo-fascist or proto-fascist or whatever kind of word you want to use to describe it. But we're seeing it rising around the world in various nations. And it's a trend, and it's something we need to understand. So I think what I want to ask, and I know this is an incredibly basic question, but I want to just get a clear definition of what neoliberalism is, because it's a word that's thrown around a lot to use to describe the socioeconomic system that we're now embedded within.
I
just want to ask you, you know, if you could provide just something of a definition of where it came from, when it started, and how it's led to the moment that we are in today.
I mean, neoliberalism, its ideological roots are in people like Milton Friedman and Hayek and a number of others. But I think that in the 1980s, the latter part of the 1970s, with the economic recession, neoliberalism all of a sudden gains enormous ground, because politically it begins with Reagan and Thatcher. It really gains enormous political strength, and it operates under the assumption that markets are self-sufficient. They don't need regulation, and that they're the best guarantees of human welfare. I mean, it's marked by an enormously irrational belief in the market, not only to control the economy, but basically to control all of social life. And those forces that promote the market, whether we're talking about privatization, deregulation, commodification, the mobility of finance capital, the abandonment of government-provided social programs, all of those things, the unleashing of capital, all of those things are seen as very productive. On the other hand, those forces that it seems to be at odds with the market, whether we're talking about government services, restrictions on finance and capital, social provisions, the welfare state, strong unions, the rise in the support for public goods, all of those things are under attack. So basically what you have is you have an economic system that in many ways exists. Its particular aim is the consolidation of class power in the hands of a financial elite. And basically what you now have is you have capital driving not just the economy, but all aspects of society. And everything is reduced to an act of commerce and measured by commercial considerations. So it really construes profit-making as sort of the essence of democracy, and buying and selling and highly competitive attitudes. Anything that degrades collaboration, solidarity, social goods, the common good, it becomes a model of war in which the self-interest and basically a kind of toxic masculinity, you know, a kind of lawlessness, now wages war against all elements of the social state and the social contract.
Okay. Well, let me ask this, if we can kind of further this point. You know, I think that there's this idea that the freest, again, you mentioned some of these people that have promoted this idea, Friedman, for example. But this idea that democracy can only flourish with free markets, with this sort of neoliberal economic system, that democracy and capitalism are basically synonymous within often how it's discussed anyway by politicians and the like. It's like those two cannot be separated. But what you seem to assert is that actually neoliberal capitalism is antithetical to a real democratic system.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that neoliberalism hates democracy in a substantive sense. It views democracy as a government that does everything it can to basically promote the interest of finance capital. And anything that would be called democracy that actually embraces the notion of social welfare, the common good, political, economic, and social rights is really seen as the enemy of capital and is seen as the enemy of neoliberalism. So it seems to me that neoliberalism and democracy are completely antithetical. There's almost nothing in neoliberalism that I would argue that benefits any substantive or elaborate or engaged notion of democracy. I mean, think about it. It views citizens as consumers. The only obligation of citizenship is consuming. I mean, it views youth as short-term investments rather than a long-term investment. It believes essentially that progress means you can plunder the planet in the interest of profit. It means that agency is in schools is learning how to memorize and take tests. I mean, it's a disimagination machine. It so narrows the concept of freedom, limiting it to basically market terms and commercial exchanges, that it empties the term of any meaning. And of course, it has almost nothing to do with questions of justice. I mean, when you look at capitalist society in its neoliberal extremes, you get massive inequality, enormous amounts of human suffering, a political system completely controlled by corporate interests. This is not democracy. It has nothing to do with democracy. Democracy is a joke. And I think that when they do employ the term, it's a cover that simply suggests that the political state is now the economic state. It's ruled by corporate interest, and that's what democracy is about. That's not democracy. That's the pathway to fascism.
Okay. Well, let me ask this, because you do talk about pedagogy and education and the ways in which neoliberalism has dismantled education, the public education system, whether that's in universities or whether that's in the public school or whatever level it is. I mean, in what ways have you observed and have you studied and documented the ways in which the neoliberal ideology has undermined education?
I mean, I think that the first thing you have to recognize is that neoliberalism doesn't view education as a public good. It views it as a private right. And in that sense, it's done everything it can to both privatize education or basically to defund it, because it sees it as the enemy of neoliberal market assumptions. And I think we have seen over the last 40 years an enormous defunding of education, particularly and not only public education, but also higher education. 40%. In some cases, I think these budgets have been cut. Look what's happened recently in Alaska, where the University of Alaska basically has just been defunded to the point where the university may have to actually close down. But I think we also see other indications. I mean, we see in public education, we see an emphasis on testing. We see an emphasis on standardization. We see an emphasis on measurement. And we increasingly see the school being defined as part of what we call the school to prison pipeline. I mean, schools are being increasingly criminalized. As the welfare state is dismantled, the punishing state emerges, and all of a sudden the model of the prison becomes the model for schooling. And so you have more security officers increasingly being hired than teachers. You have a disimagination machine at work in schools, which seems to suggest that any notion of critical thinking, any notion of teachers having some autonomy over the conditions of their labor is at odds with anything that makes sense to both Democrats and liberals. You have teachers being de-skilled. You have resources being dried up. That's about the death of public education. With regard to higher education, it's shocking what has happened since the 1980s. I mean, when I went into education in the 1970s at Boston University, 70% of the faculty were on tenure track lines. Now 70% basically are adjuncts. So faculty have lost their power under this neoliberal regime. Presidents are now talked about as CEOs. A business culture has replaced basically an educational culture as a model for leadership. What you also see is you see increasingly governors all over the United States making the claim that courses and notions of particular forms of study that don't translate immediately into profits should be eliminated. So feminist study, ecological study, you know, all the things that basically matter in terms of educating people to be critical citizens are now diminished, downplayed, or simply viewed with disdain, while anything that serves the market in the most immediate sense of turning students into basically entrepreneurs is celebrated. So it seems to me that, you know, the cost here is that one of the most important sites for educating students to be informed and critically engaged citizens has now been so dismantled that the question has to be raised, you know, which sites are left in which people can actually learn how to hold power accountable, how to think critically, how to sort of expand their capacities and range of knowledges so that they learn how to govern rather than simply be governed. It's a very serious crisis. The crisis of democracy is about the crisis of education is about the crisis of democracy. You can't do it any other way. And neoliberalism has played an enormously powerful role. I mean, look at what's happened under this president, Trump. He hates public education. He hates higher education. He's an anti-intellectual. He puts in charge a secretary of education who has an enormously horrible record around her view of public education. She's a billionaire who basically, Betsy DeVos, who supports charter schools, privatization, the deregulation of all those kinds of civil rights that are applicable to higher education and public education. It's really sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was gonna point to DeVos and her, the fact that she has no, seemingly from what I understand, before she, when she was put in that position by Trump, everybody was like, well, why would you put someone who has no experience in public or any sort of education, why would you put someone like that into a position where she's basically enacting all these policies within the education system in the United States? And again, I think people were baffled because people don't have this understanding of what maybe the agenda really is here.
I think there are two issues. I mean, I think that at one level, Trump was very well aware. I mean, Trump likes, you know, he likes incompetent people. He sort of celebrates incompetency. And at the same time, he celebrates people who will be loyal to him in terms of the neoliberal ideology that he basically epitomizes. I mean, he's a billionaire who basically loves to be in bed with dictators and the rich. And so it seems to me that Betsy DeVos was the perfect candidate. I mean, she has lots of money, which he's in awe of. She hates public education, which he believes in. And basically, she's stupid enough to be completely indifferent to the ethical and political consequences of what she does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I wanted to, it's maybe a little sidetrack, but I think it's a good example of the ways in which neoliberalism tries to kind of further its agenda, I guess, in this realm. So speaking about public education, I mean, this phenomenon, and there's multi-levels to talk, you know, talking about this subject of mass shootings and school shootings. But something you bring up, and I think this was brought up in your recent piece for Truthout, neoliberalism paved the way for authoritarian right-wing populism. I think you mentioned in there, if I remember correctly, about the ways in which Trump and probably previous administrations, I imagine. I don't think it's just him, but maybe he's really furthered it to the point where it's really absurd and really obvious. But if you could speak to the ways in which, through this sort of neoliberal ideology, the ways in which schools and public education and that has handled or has tried to handle or tried to deal with in its own way the violence that we're seeing in, say, public spaces like schools.
I think that what I mean, I think the thing you have to remember, there are three things that are crucial here. One is you've got a country governed by a notion of fear that basically reduces fear to sort of personal injury. You know, the fear of the mugger, the fear of the pedophile, the fear of the terrorist. So you don't have a notion of fear that's about the fear of poverty, the fear of not having a place to live, the fear of, you know, not having decent health care. So that notion of fear feeds in to a very neoliberal notion of security, which basically is that security is basically about protecting the body. It's about the discourse of violence in a very limited kind of way. But more importantly, it's about an industry. Security is about an industry. It feeds the arms industries, and so you have a perfect union here, a perfect storm, in which this mobilization of fear around violence in schools feeds into the notion that the only way to deal with that violence is to basically simply impose all kinds of security measures that basically balloon the profits of the arms industry. That's the first issue. The second issue is that, remember, you know, increasingly, if schools are defined less around a model of critical learning and citizenship and as a public good, and are increasingly defined as places ruled by fear and insecurity, then increasingly students are treated as potential criminals. And so you have the zero tolerance policies that have been going on since the 1980s that suggest basically that we have to do everything we can to protect students from themselves because they're untrustworthy. And so therefore you have more police in the schools. You have all kinds of security measures from, you know, ways in which students enter the school to the way they're monitored, to the surveillance cameras that are controlling their behavior. But increasingly, their behaviors are being criminalized. I mean, all of a sudden, we see kids being pulled out of schools for violating dress codes and put into police cars and handcuffed. In some cases, five-year-olds and six-year-olds and seven-year-olds are being arrested, as was recently in the news, and handcuffed for having a temper tantrum. That's the second issue, the criminalization of public education. The third issue is that there's an enormous, it seems to me, discrepancy between young people who were saying, hey, look, we want a decent education and we really want to address the fundamental causes of violence in this country. We don't believe that turning schools into prisons and high surveillance tech places is really going to solve the problem. And so there's a massive revolt on the part of students from Parkland and a whole range of other places who are saying, we've got to get at the heart of this problem because this neoliberal logic based on fear, based on the accumulation of profits, and based on viewing students as basically untrustworthy and potential criminals is not going to work. At another level, you have teachers who are walking out all over the country and striking because they're saying, if you really want to talk about the violence in schools, talk about the violence being waged against teachers' unions. Talk about the violence being waged against students whose imaginations are being crippled by virtues of pedagogies of repression and pedagogies of memorization and test-taking. If you really want to talk about violence in schools, talk about what it means not to have the resources to deal with students who are troubled, but instead to pump endless amounts of and millions of dollars into arming teachers and into security measures that have nothing to do with public education.
Yeah, it seems like what you pointed to in your work is that everything, particularly with education, using that as an example, is it's like it becomes a prison in a sense. It starts to emulate or replicate some of the aspects of what we see in prison culture. And what's even more grotesque is it's not just prisons, it's the privatization that comes with prison as well. It's like that's the other layer to it. It's like, oh, it's not just a prison. They're trying to make money at the same time.
No, Patrick, this is so important in terms of your question, which is a terrific question. I don't want to go on too long about it, but I think that, you know, at the root of capital is the need for profits, not human needs, not the addressing of human needs. And so it seems to me that, you know, to miss the connection between the criminalization of public spaces such as schools and the increasing criminalization of social problems, you have another logic, you know, that logic being that all problems are individual problems. And so therefore, there are no systemic problems. And so it becomes difficult to translate private troubles into larger systemic issues. So therefore, we don't link the violence in schools to basically larger corporate interests that are criminogenic in terms of their need to make money. On the other hand, what we do is we say, look, people are crazy. It's all about mental health. We have to you know, impose more gun laws. We have to give teachers weapons. We have to do everything we can to make sure that students don't get smart because they could become dangerous. I mean, it's almost hallucinogenic in its both its analysis and in its consequences.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly criminogenic, no question about that.
Okay, yeah, and you know, getting back again, just using the kind of the hollowing out of public education, and in what way has this created a society? I know there's a lot of resistance to this, and on the local and maybe on the broader scale as well. But I do see this sense that people's general understanding of things, of the direction we're going politically in this country, speaking in the United States specifically, that much of that is sort of this lack of critical thinking, lack of historical context, kind of infantilizing. I sort of see this sort of infantilizing sort of thing where people can't really seem to get their head around certain trends or topics, and I wonder how much of that is due to the hollowing out, due to neoliberal economic and social policies in public education. You know, people basically, you describe, you know, memorization, testing as being the focus of schools. How much has that, I mean, in whatever way we can maybe try to fit this in, but how has that trend led to a population which is, you know, seemingly, because I see much of the rise of authoritarian and fascist tendencies coming from what we would define as the working class. You know, you can't really have a successful populist right-wing movement without, you know, a gang of supporters. So how has the hollowing out of public education through neoliberalism maybe paved the way in many ways for a rising right-wing populism?
I mean, I think that when you look at the attack on public education, you're also looking at something else. The attack on public education becomes a model for an attack on civic culture. It becomes a model for attack on all those public institutions that basically raise the bar intellectually and theoretically in terms of giving people an opportunity to understand the conditions under which they find themselves and to be able to act on those conditions, not just individually, but also collectively. I mean, remember, you know, you have a culture that is so steeped in a consumerist ethic that it panders in many ways to a kind of anti-intellectualism that gives rise to a whole range of cultural spheres that replace, in my estimation, spheres that are engaged in what I would call the intellectual pursuit of the capacity for having a real sense of engaged agency. I mean, you have a culture now that you have a society governed by celebrity culture. This is a culture of stupidity and idiocy. You have a culture dominated by game shows. You have a culture in which, in many ways, reality TV becomes the ultimate model that mimics a sort of neoliberalism understanding of a kind of deranged sort of what I would call competitive and highly regressive notion of individualism. You have this notion of privatization that endlessly says that, you know, it's impossible to translate, to go back real problems into larger systemic issues. You have this incredible fragmentation in the culture. And it seems to me that this culture of self-absorption that's encouraged by the new technologies, how the modern media increasingly blurs the distinction between fact and fiction. And I guess what I'm getting at is that the attack on public education is really nothing more than a microcosm of the attack on all those institutions that produce a formative culture that operates off the assumption that you can have a democracy without informed citizens. That formative culture has now been transformed into a regressive, privatized, commodified culture. And I think in that sense, the mobilizing passions of fascism have been unleashed in a culture of ignorance in which people want to blame other people for the problems that they have. They increasingly embrace a notion of leadership in which they believe in the great man who will save them. You know, they believe in simplistic answers. James Baldwin once said, one of the great tragedies of any society is the merging of anti-intellectualism, ignorance, and power. And I think that's what we've seen happen under neoliberalism since the 1980s mm-hmm. in the United States.
Okay. Well, and I want to point to the, because again, I think that it's important to understand where a figure like Trump, who is seemingly catalyzing many of these things that you've just discussed in our society. But I think something that I really want to point to is the ways in which, you know, you talk about the ways in which language, dehumanizing language, sets the stage for this sort of dehumanization that we're seeing right now. There's us versus them kind of thing that we're seeing. And I want to point to the ways in which not just Trump, who's so obvious about his disdain for minorities, immigrants, you know, people that he views as the other. But I want to talk about, say, the ways that previous presidencies, previous leaders that we've had, you know, like Obama or Clinton or Bush or any of these previous presidencies that we've had that have definitely furthered the neoliberal economic and social agendas. But they were such they were very polite politicians, I guess you could say, compared to what we have with Trump. If I could ask about the ways in which a sort of a neoliberal language has been used to set the stage for this rising fascism and authoritarianism in the United States, and maybe using examples from presidents that we don't normally associate with that, like Obama, for instance. What is some of the language that's used to do that?
I mean, look, you know, Reagan began his presidency attacking welfare queens.
Mm.
I mean, Reagan began his as a governor, basically traded in red baiting, particularly around somebody like Angela Davis. I mean, when you look at Bush, the first Bush, I mean, you know, he gave us the Willie Horton ads. You know, when you look at the way in which Cheney and that Bush regime emerged with its endless lies, its implicit coded sexism and racism, you have to understand something, and that is that fascism starts with language, and it starts with the language of brutality, which essentially, if used long enough, becomes normalized. I mean, there's a long tradition in the United States in which this neoliberal narrative of separating people along lines of friends and enemy has always been racially and class and gender coded. It was just, you know, it was just hidden a bit, it seems to me, with some of these people. I mean, it wasn't as overt as it is, of course, with Trump. I mean, Trump brings the surface elements of this language of fascism to the center of politics. That's what he does. I mean, the origins of the fascism in terms of its ultra-nationalism, you know, it's a template, the discourse of decline, its contempt, not just for liberalism, but for intellectual thought, the claim that America is always in crisis, the contempt for weakness. I mean, what this language, particularly since the 1980s, has produced is not only a racist ecosystem, a class-based hatred of justice and equality, but it also has produced a language of disposability and a culture of cruelty that is unlike anything we have seen. I mean, look, let's go back to somebody like Clinton. I mean, people talk about Clinton as the great savior because there was a somewhat of an economic boom during his regime. Clinton, to me, in many ways, was horrible in terms of what he did around expanding the punishment state, imposing laws around three strikes and you're out, law and order agenda that put millions, I mean hundreds of thousands of people of color in prison. His what he did to dismantle basically the economy by going after the Glass-Steagall Act, what he did by attacking welfare rolls. I mean, these are all instances of a language that basically sees the other as excess, that sees the other as disposable, that sees the other as non-human in some way. This is the language, Patrick, of objectification. It's a language of reification. And when you dehumanize people and you reify them long enough, that language operates in the service of violence. I mean, think about Trump's language, which is right out. I mean, this is the language of war. This is the language of hatred. It's the language of ethnic cleansing. It's the language of racial purity. It's the language of white supremacy. I mean, it's a language in which certain groups are seen as not only expendable, but actually, when he says, as he recently allegedly claimed that border guards should shoot immigrants in the legs, or accuses people in Congress or anybody who disagrees with him of treason, I mean, this is the language of war. This is the language of war. This is a contempt for people who disagree. It elevates instinct over emotion. It's anti-intellectual. It has a contempt. It exhibits a contempt for the rule of law, and it harbors an enormous fear of what we call the other. It's an elimination language. And what scares me is that the misery imposed by neoliberalism, with its massive engine of social death its massive engine of basically human suffering and misery, its endless production of massive inequalities in wealth and power, has now paved the way for a kind of neo-fascist discourse that merges with racial purity, white supremacy, and ethnic cleansing.
Okay. Well, I want to kind of talk a little more about language, because there was a part in the article that I mentioned that you had published in Truthout, in which we talk about how right-wing populists create diversions and distract away from neoliberal inequities. I'll just quote something really quick here, just to set the stage here. You say, "In a masterful act of political diversion, populist leaders attacked all vestiges of liberal capitalism while refusing to name neoliberal inequities in wealth and power as a basic threat to their societies. Instead of calling for an acceleration of the democratic ideals of popular sovereignty and equality, right-wing populist leaders such as Trump, Bolsonaro, and Hungary's Viktor Orban defined democracy as the enemy of those who wish for unaccountable power. They also diverted genuine popular anger into the abyss of cultural chauvinism, anti-immigrant hatred, and a contempt of Muslims, and a targeted attack on the environment, healthcare, education, public institutions, social provisions, and other basic life resources." So I think this is interesting, because it's like something that I kind of sensed as Trump was gearing up for the election, was a sense that he was talking about, you know, globalization in a sense, or globalism, I guess, is kind of the word I hear often on the right when we talk about a global economic system. So he was speaking to, for instance, so-called free trade agreements as undermining, U.S. sovereignty and empowerment of workers in the United States, which is something that's actually true, right? But of course, then it's a diversion after that. It's not actually addressing the underlying structure of neoliberalism. You're not going to hear Trump present a well-articulated, well-researched critique of neoliberalism at all. No, he's going to blame immigrants. He's going to blame the other. He's going to use language of dehumanization in order to further his campaign and sort of build his base. So if you could talk a little bit about the ways in which right-wing populists use... They touch on it just enough to get people to understand, like, okay, he's on my side. He's going to use his power for me and for my own. But then divert that towards a sort of anger, a resentment, a fracturing of the culture in general.
No, Patrick, you've said it more eloquently than I have. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, what they have done is they've tapped into real problems in some cases that people are facing. But they've only tapped into those problems in order to mobilize the fear and the outrage in ways that benefit their own economic and political interests. That's the difference. I mean, they don't tap into outrage in ways to reveal very basic underlying economic and political factors that have produced the suffering that people have now find themselves in, whether we're talking about the desolated landscapes all over the United States that have been produced as a result of globalization, or they don't talk about the housing crisis and how poor people had to pay, and how the Obamas of the world sort of bailed out the bankers and the Goldman people from Goldman Sachs. They don't really talk about how capitalism in a sense has nothing to do with the needs of the people that they're concerned about. I mean, I think that when you live in a culture marked by the kind of anti-intellectualism that we find in the United States, it becomes very easy to sort of mobilize people in ways in which you actually point to a real problem, but then you divert the issue in ways to suggest, don't worry, I alone can solve this problem, when in fact, the people who are arguing that are basically people who believe in a value system that has produced the problem. I mean, mm-hmm. Trump claims he's for the working people. He's going to produce infrastructure. He's going to, in a sense, do something about health care. And so forth and so on. When in fact, what he's done is pass regressive tax measures that benefit the rich. He's deregulated all kinds of safety and business and ecological policies that are going to hurt poor people because their children are going to suffer under a debased ecosystem that's collapsing. He has no interest whatsoever in addressing the healthcare system, except to make it more difficult for people to actually get health insurance. And so it seems to me you have a switch and bait discourse here. At one level, we point to some of capitalism's problems, particularly global capitalism. At another level, we mobilize those fears, genuine fears in some cases, on the part of people who are suffering from these problems, in ways that completely divert the issue by blaming Mexicans, by blaming immigrants, by blaming Muslims. And so in a sense, what you have here is you have the merging of the problems caused by global neoliberalism with, in fact, the appropriation of a fascist politics that trades in white supremacy, ethnic cleansing, and white nationalism. So this is a very interesting kind of move because it represents the merging, in many ways, of neoliberalism, fascism, neoliberal fascism, as both a project and a movement. As a project, of course, neoliberalism destroys all the commanding institutions of democracy while consolidating power in the hands of relatively few, a financial elite. And as a movement, it endlessly legitimates and further reproduces economic quality, massive suffering, the privatization of public goods, the dismantling of essential government agencies, and it individualizes social problems. And that's exactly what Trump did.
Okay. Well, why is it then, and I know you mentioned this, you talk about the 2011 Occupy movement, Occupy Wall Street, Occupy movement here in the U.S., which actually we saw it manifest in other parts of the world as well. That, for me at least, that was the last time that I really saw something of just an inkling of a possibility that the left would unify under some sort of common goal of addressing economic inequality, the neoliberal ideology. And this, of course, happened in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, as I think a bit of a reaction to it. Of course, we saw, whether it was through police repression, state repression of the movement, or just a lack of cohesion within the Occupy movement itself, with all of its strengths and all of its weaknesses, it just seemed to have not really to really have carried to the present moment. We're, 8 years out since that movement started, and I haven't really seen anything even close to that emerge again within the left. Now, within certain contexts, I've seen, for instance, a sort of, as you mentioned, with public education, teachers walking out, students walking out, strikes. I've seen some in sort of local, in a localized sense, there is, in some places, a strong leftist current or movement. But as far as a broad social movement that we could say across the United States or across the world, I just don't see the left's response to this trend. Maybe I'm wrong in saying that. Maybe you're seeing something that I'm not. But I guess I could ask this question. In what ways has the left maybe successfully and also unsuccessfully responded to the neoliberal fascist trend that we're seeing today?
It's a fabulous question and probably the most important question that the left has to face today. I mean, let me see to break this down in three categories. I mean, first of all, I don't think that demonstrations are movements. I mean, I think that demonstrations are very short-lived moments of outrage that bring people together to kind of amplify an issue. And I think as important as they are pedagogically, and it was important certainly for the Occupy movement because it did put the question of inequality on the map. And that's important. But you need sustained movements. You need movements with institutions. You need movements that basically are comprehensive. You need movements that bring other diverse movements together into a larger political party. That was a moment of outrage, but it was not a political formation. It was not a political formation that translated immediately into the need for a third political party that could actually challenge the two existing parties and make a case for democratic socialism. Secondly, it seems to me, is that the left has failed enormously around the question of education. And what I mean by that is that education is really not central to how it understands politics. It for too long has focused on particular structures. It is fragmented in many ways, the kinds of politics that it deals with. But it doesn't really, in a sense, make education central to politics in ways in which it can produce narratives in which working class people and other oppressed groups can actually recognize themselves. In other words, it doesn't take seriously the need to first build all the things that are needed for a formative culture at work, to change the consciousness of people. You know, if you're going to be on the left, you've got to be able to talk to people. Mm-hmm. If you're in the academy, you've got to be able to translate what you say into ways that people can understand. I mean, where are the public intellectuals on the left? I mean, certainly, I think journalists in the United States have risen to that occasion in some ways. And increasingly, there's podcasts like yours and alternative media. But this is politics follows culture. And it seems to me until the left can address that and be able to mobilize the educational movements, why don't the labor unions have their own television stations? Why aren't they producing massive papers in conjunction with other unions that can educate people? This fight over education is absolutely central to politics. And until the left learns that, it's in trouble. I think that what it never has understood, that the most important forms of domination are not only economic, they're also pedagogical. They're also about the symbolic. They're about notions of persuasion. They're about a politics of identification. And so it seems to me that's the second issue. The third issue is, I mean, the left is so splintered. And this is not an argument against recognizing the diverse forms of oppression that operate under capitalism, whether we're talking about an attack on minority sexual rights, or that we're talking about an attack on certain notions of identity politics or ecological politics. But we need a comprehensive understanding of how the system works. We have to bring these elements together so that we're talking about a really horrible notion of neoliberal capitalism and not just talking about very specific issues. We've got to bring these movements together in terms of a larger theoretical understanding of how the forces of domination actually work. We've got to create a comprehensive politics, and we've got to create an educational apparatus that allows people to understand these issues so that they can act on them.
Okay. Well, let's sort of put the stakes here, because as the right-wing populist movement, the force, the ideology of it continues almost unimpeded, it feels like to me. You know, there is a looming recession. That's something that I'm hearing over and over again. I know Trump was posed a question maybe several times in some press conferences, but they said, you know, what do you think about this? And of course, you know, he gives his regular answer. He takes it very personally. Like, why would you even bring that up? You know, that's not even something that's going to happen. We have the strongest economy ever under my presidency, blah, blah, blah. but that really is something that Trump can't actually control. He could maybe lay off the trade war thing, but in general, there seems to be this looming recession that's far bigger than anything Trump or any of members of his administration can really really adequately address or stop. So, what's at stake here? I mean, you talk about some of the inadequacies of the left and what needs to be done in order to organize. We have a real serious problem here of a looming recession. Which is going to lead to even more fragmentation, more impoverishment. And if we already have this swelling of right-wing resentment in the population, I mean, I don't know if you're comfortable making predictions or projections on this, but I mean, what's really coming for us if we don't really organize right now and get to the heart of the issue?
I mean, I think the your last comment is really the most important aspect of that analysis, and that is that, you know, look, we have if we have an what we have seen since 2008, and what we might be seeing with the potential recession that's coming, which is, as you say, is being predicted by a lot of economists, is that the economic crisis has to be matched by a crisis of ideas, and that we have to be able to link that crisis to a crisis of both democracy and capitalism. And unless we do that, I think that it's very likely that we could find ourselves under the regime dominated by a right-wing populist movement that would really be quite dangerous all around if in some ways we're not there already. I mean, I think that I don't want to be dystopian, because I do believe that the possibilities for resistance are enormous. And I think that what we're beginning to see is among farmers and among coal miners and others, there really is a growing sense that Trump is a fraud, that the system is not working for people, that we need different answers. And I think that if teachers can continue to mobilize, if young people can mobilize, if in fact Bernie Sanders can come back and others who are arguing for a form of democratic socialism can make their voices louder, then there might be a groundswell that's very different from the one that might be predicted, the rise of a neo-fascist state. So I think that that's the issue. I mean, I think that more and more people have to speak out. More and more people have to mobilize. The stakes are too high. I mean, there is absolutely no alternative to the kinds of resistance that is needed to stop this movement towards an intensified form of fascist politics. There's no, I mean, you're either complicitous or you're not. I hate to deal with that kind of binarism, but I think we're operating under a system which the planet is in peril. The levels of inequality are overwhelming. I mean, three people in the United States own as much as half the population in terms of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Economics drives policies. I mean, how much longer can this sustain itself? And with the recession, it'll get worse because the policies that will be enacted will benefit the rich, safeguard the rich, and hurt working class and middle class people even more. So it seems to me there's an enormous opportunity here to begin to really narrow down and begin to produce a narrative that people can cling to that has five or six points about Medicare, about eliminating inequality, about eliminating corporate power, and so forth and so on, that people all of a sudden can see and address and be able to identify in terms of how it affects their own lives. We need another narrative because we are living under the most powerful narrative since the divine right of kings, and that's neoliberal ideology. I mean, it says there's no alternative, says the market is really the essence of what it means to be alive. It says that all problems are individual. It says that people should be endlessly isolated. I mean, remember, you have a country where the suicide rate now is almost overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the level of social atomization is overwhelming. All the conditions exist to seize upon the possibility for a narrative, an alternative left-wing democratic socialist narrative that could actually mobilize people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I want to get your opinion on this as a final note here, because I think, I don't know if I could say that the left as a really broad term is necessarily too fixated on this, but I would like to get your opinion on this, because right now there's this impeachment inquiry that's unfolding right now with Trump. And I mean, I honestly, if I could speak for myself, I'm not too hopeful that it's going to really lead to anything. It's the same thing with the Mueller report. It kind of just fell flat. You know, as much corruption as we're seeing, documented corruption that we're seeing from the Trump administration, I just have little faith that our institutions is really going to check this and going to stop him, and particularly within, what, less than 2 years from a presidential election.
I refuse to even write about it because it's a sideshow to me. I don't think we should impeach Trump. We should impeach the system. Now, the system needs to be impeached. And if we want to make that connection, I'm all for it. But I think that this impeachment discourse that the left now seems so absorbed with, I mean, is there anything that we don't know? Do we not know he's corrupt? Do we not know he's a racist? Do we not know that he puts personal gain above the public good? I mean, do we not know that in some way he hates the rule of law? Do we not know that he surrounds himself with incompetent people because he believes there's a correlation between loyalty and patriotism? I mean, what's new here? Except that he basically plundered in making obvious that he's trying to bribe foreign leaders in order to implement his own political aspirations. So it seems to me that as long as we're talking about this and we're not talking about health care, we're not talking about Medicare, we're not talking about the plundering of the environment, we're not talking about the collapse of public education, we're off track. You know, it's a narrative that basically diverts us from what we really should be talking about. And it ties into something that is crucial to what I call the logic of the disimagination machines. And that is a media who hops on the spectacle because it raises it expands their audiences and raises their profits. This is a media scam. I mean, they love this stuff. 24/7, impeach Trump, go over every word endlessly. It just strikes me as a losing battle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I feel like that's kind of the thing, you know, and kind of getting back to the way language, you talk about, right-wing populists creating diversions, distracting away from the actual neoliberal system, you know, touching on it just enough to get people riled up, but not really getting to the root of it and diverting that attention away towards disenfranchised groups of people. But it also, I mean, I'm seeing this, yeah, like you said, within the media, the jumping on the spectacle of it, it's the same kind of diversion that I'm seeing with the right wing. Yeah.
I mean, it's a diversion. I mean, I was thinking today, you know, Trump increasingly is used the language of civil war. He's talking about how dissent can be equated with treason. You know, he's talking about shooting people in the legs. I mean, we should look at that language and ask ourselves, you know, what is the history of that language in the United States? Where does it come from? How has it set policies that basically are at odds with any substantive notion of democracy? And in what way has democracy been so flawed in the past that nobody even wants to talk about it anymore because they equate it with forms of exploitation and domination? I mean, it seems to me these are real questions that need to be addressed. And while we might enter into that narrative about impeachment by blowing it up and linking it to the underlying forces of authoritarianism, we don't do it. But it's an opportunity. And some people on the left, Chris Hedges does it. A few people do it. I mean, Robin DJ Kelly is brilliant on this stuff. There are people doing it, but they're not on CNN, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. These are not the people that are invited to MSNBC. I mean, it doesn't work that way. And so I think that those of us who operating within the alternative media have to continuously go at this. I mean, I think the thing that shocks me the most is to hear these people on the left claiming this is not fascism, because fascism is a very specific historical moment that can't be repeated and that we have nothing to really learn from history here. I mean, I find that shocking. after Hannah Arendt, after Sheldon Wolin, I mean, fascism is never really interred in just one historical moment. It takes many forms under very different historical conditions. And not to recognize that in light, as you said earlier in the program, of the rising right-wing populist movements all over the United States is just tragic to me. Just tragic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there is this unfortunate thing I see as well where people can't really seem to acknowledge that the fascism that's rising today is not necessarily going to look, although it will be similar in many frightening ways, but doesn't necessarily look like the fascism of the Nazi Party in the 1930s and 40s. It's not going to look like the fascism of Mussolini's Italy. It's gonna be very much a product of say, for instance, the history of the United States and everything that's led up to it.
Absolutely. Whether we're talking about the ultranationalism, whether we're talking about the call to racial purity, ethnic cleansing, whether we're talking about the elevation of instinct over emotion, reason over emotion, the politics of disposability, the contempt for weakness, it's all there. And we know what the end point is. I mean, we know what the end point is. I mean, you know, when you look at young children being ripped from their parents' arms and being put in detention centers where they're being, many of them being sexually and physically abused, and to claim this has no correlation and doesn't echo something from the past that we should be aware of in terms of where it really ended up. I don't know where to go with that.
Yeah, well, it's just a sense of denial. And I think people, if they sense, oh, if I pretend it's not really there, then maybe it'll go away. But that, of course, is a losing game. And I think calling things what they are and being very direct and honest about it, while not misrepresenting by using words like fascism when it's not, but I think you are, Henry, I think you've really pointed to something that is truly fascistic and that is truly rising. And I think that is deeply important in this time to speak truth to power and speak truth to these subjects.
And remember, Patrick, I use the word neoliberal fascism.
Okay. Yeah.
Fascism. I say neoliberal fascism, which suggests that this is a very distinctive historical moment that draws from a number of traditions in the past. So I'm not just saying this is fascism per se, unadulterated, purely representative and mimicking something in the past. I'm talking about a new political conjuncture, and that's very different. And I don't really hear anybody else talking about that in that way.
Right. Yeah. Thank you for clarifying that. Yeah. And I just want to say here as a final note, I mean, I'll just ask this last question here, and this really points to your most recent book that was published by Los Angeles Review of Books, The Terror of the Unforeseen. What is that book's title really pointing to? I know maybe it's alluding to what we've already discussed up to this point and without necessarily being too repetitive, but if I could just ask you very quickly before we wrap up and, if we could talk about that.
It points to two things. The unforeseen is the unexpected, in that we may find ourselves in a period of neoliberal fascism that basically could mean the end of even the ideal of democracy in the United States. But the unforeseen also points to the possibility of understanding and recognizing that and taking education seriously in terms of what it means to change the collective consciousness of people so that they can basically act in ways in which the utopian promise of struggle can actually become a reality.
Okay. Yeah, and I would just want people to go check out that book. You, as I mentioned maybe at the beginning of this, I don't know if it was before the interview started or not, but I said that you were very prolific, and that wasn't quite a strong enough word. You are just relentless in how much you put out. I mean, you seem deeply impassioned and just in these subjects, and I think that I just find your work to be deeply necessary and profound and timely, to say the very least. And I just want to turn people on. So, of course, in the description of this episode, I'll provide links to everything. But I know there's, of course, your website. You've got your book, The Terror of the Unforeseen. You're on Twitter. Is there... I know that when we were setting this interview up, you mentioned you had some rather big projects that you were working on. Is there anything that you'd like to maybe share about what you have coming up in the future?
I think one of the things that I'm absolutely concerned about right now is the way in which people get depoliticized, the collapse of what I would call a radical sense of agency, because I don't think we're sensitive enough to the ways in which the culture inhabits a politics that empties politics of any meaning, whether it be through a narrative that says that people don't count, or one that says that democracy is merely about elections, or one that says that education, if you're smart, is something that we need to be resentful over, or one that says that solidarity no longer has any value. I'm deeply concerned about that. And I'm deeply concerned about trying to put something together around the rising notion of populism, in which we would argue that education has to be central to understanding a way to oppose that populism.
Okay. All right. Well, Henry, that's all I got. I think you were incredible. I really thank you for breaking all of those things down. Again, repeating myself again, but your work is truly timely and it is indispensable. So I would just admonish people to really go check out your work. There's a lot there, but at the very least, go check out your articles at Truth Out, where you publish quite regularly there. And you flesh out all these ideas in a spectacular fashion. And also your book, The Terror of the Unforeseen. And Henry, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Patrick, listen, thank you for a fabulous interview. Really well thought out questions. You know, interviews don't work unless interviewers do their work. and you have really done that today. So I'm really honored.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Hey there, thanks for listening. If you'd like to support this project monetarily, here are a few options. You can send a one-time donation to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast, and you can treat that a bit like a tip jar. And if you'd really like to sustain this work, consider supporting the project through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/lastbornin the wilderness and donate to the production of this podcast for $1 or more a month. And by doing that, you'll gain early access to these interviews and discussions before the official public release, and also gain access to some exclusive content there as well. As a great psychedelic bard Terrence McKenna said, take it easy, dude, but take it.